You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, more than 50 people were indicted this week as part of a nationwide college admission bribery case. We'll learn more about what happened and have a conversation about the state of higher education in the United States. First, violent crime has been on a downward trend nationwide since the 1990s, but it's still a big issue facing some of the nation's major cities and raising questions about the best ways police departments can prevent that violent crime. For decades, one of the more common methods departments have used is low-level enforcement, also known as broken windows policing, that focuses on punishing smaller crimes to prevent further disorder. Our next guest says the data shows this approach misunderstands the real nature of urban crime. He says taking a closer look at who commits violent crime and why should bring us to a new way of policing areas that are considered the most violent. Stephen Lurie is a writer and former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities. His recent piece for City Lab is under the headline, "There's No Such Thing as a Dangerous Neighborhood." Stephen, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with this concept of broken windows policing. When it came out, what was the theory? What was the idea behind it?
Sure. So originally, the idea of a broken windows theory is the concept that if you have broken windows in a given neighborhood, in a given area, that this is a signal to people, to signal to other people in the area that this is a lawless area. And that through this signal that there's a broken window and no one is fixing it, it will encourage people who see that signal to commit further crimes, to be able to be confident in the idea that they too will not get caught in doing things such as property destruction or breaking into a house or breaking into a car. And the theory originally went on to say that this is a chain that continues until you encourage criminality in a way that can lead to even more serious crime, including violence.
How did that translate into police procedure?
Sure. So if you are convinced by this theory, naturally you would think, well, if we know that there are going to be criminals or people who commit criminal activity that will start at a low level but eventually lead to violence, your theory of change might be to try to prevent violence by starting at the source, by cracking down on those initial thoughts, those initial opportunities that one perceives as an opportunity for criminal activity. So if you're a police department, and many police departments did do this, your response is going to be to arrest people for low-level infractions, to question them on the street for suspicious activity, to stop and frisk them for potential drugs or contraband. And in that way, the theory goes, you're going to ultimately prevent violence. What we know now is that that's simply not how it works.
Right. Looking back at the data, looking at the places that did and didn't adopt this broken windows, this low-level enforcement process, what have we learned about whether or not it works?
Well, the evidence quite overwhelmingly is that there's no real connection between cracking down on low-level offenses and preventing violent crime. And the reason is that those two chains are not linked. The fact is that people who are committing low-level infractions, which in reality is pretty much everyone, from those who drink underage to those who speed and break the law, are not the same people or are not exclusively the same people as those who commit violence. And the people who do commit violence are doing so in particular reasons, for particular reasons, due to particular motivations. And the preponderance of evidence, in fact, shows us that when you try to enforce upon those low-level infractions as a way of preventing violence, you're actually more likely to alienate the communities that you're trying to serve by intruding upon their personal life, by intruding upon their community life in a way that can be disruptive, that can be violent, and that can break down the trust that one would need to actually prevent violence in situations where that sort of enforcement is called for.
Talking to Stephen Lurie, writer, former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities, talking about a piece he wrote for City Lab about broken windows policing, who commits violent crime, and what might work best to prevent that crime. And Stephen, a lot of the heart of your piece is in what you were just talking about, looking at who is committing violent crime in a community. What do we know?
Well, let me first start by saying that there are multiple types of violence in a community and in any place. You will have private violence in the home, intimate partner violence, and you'll have community violence out in the public sphere. And what I talk about in the article and in my research is particularly about the problem of community violence. And what we look at is the data from a bunch of cities over a bunch of years, over 20 cities over 20 years. And we're looking at the fact that when we count up the total number of homicides in a given city, when we count up the total number of shootings, what we find is that nearly 50%, around 50% of those homicides or shootings is connected to a very, very, very small percentage of any given city. And that very, very small percentage, usually about a half of one percentage point, are the people, usually young men in disadvantaged communities, young men of color, who are connected to what we refer to as street groups, what other people might refer to as gangs, sets, crews, or posses. And that there's an intense, intense concentration of the serious violence in our cities among these groups, that really tells us that if we're going to try and prevent violence in a serious way, if we want to try and prevent what constitutes nearly half of all homicides and shootings in many American cities, we should be focusing our resources on those young men who are both vulnerable to being victimized themselves and vulnerable to picking up a gun and committing violence themselves.
And there's a horrible irony there for members of these gangs or whatever we want to call them, that because they might not feel like the authorities make them safe, they've lost trust in police, for example, they feel like they might need to join a gang for their own safety, for their own protection, which then makes them far more likely to commit or be on the receiving end of a crime.
That's exactly right. And what we can call that is a protection paradox, right? The idea that you join a gang, you join together with other people for protection in the hopes that it will make you safer. But in reality, what we find is that it actually identifies you as someone who is more likely to be in conflict, who's more likely to be around weapons that can lead to dangerous situations, and more likely to use violence as a way to settle disputes because you don't trust in the official authorities to be there for you to solve the disputes that you need solved.
If you were trying to craft a police policy targeting that, preventing that, as you say, about 50% of homicides in a community done by a half a percent of the population of that community, what would that kind of policing look like?
So the first thing that I would note is that that sort of policing has to be in tandem, in conjunction with the communities where this violence is occurring. It has to be in conjunction with social service and support agencies who serve those communities. That the policing function has to be part of an effort to boost the fact that these communities, from the beginning, are already overwhelmingly resilient and overwhelmingly able to prevent violence themselves. And so what you'd look for is the type of policing that we've seen in many strategies that sometimes go by the name of focused deterrence strategies or group violence interventions that are going to pair the capacities of law enforcement with community organizations, with social service support agencies to focus attention on that really small population and to be able to get them support that they need, the protection that they need, and get them connected to the community voices that are there trying to prevent the violence already.
We're talking to Stephen Lurie right now about research into the dynamics of urban violence, the history of broken window policing, and thinking about crime as a product of small, in effect, social networks. A lot of violent crime committed by a very small set of people within a community. What should a police response look like? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your reactions to the ideas our guest is bringing up? If you live or have lived somewhere people have called a violent neighborhood, what did that look like to you? What did it look like to live in it? What was policing like there? If you're in law enforcement yourself, what have you seen that works or doesn't work when it comes to violence prevention in the communities you work in? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Stephen Lurie, a writer and former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities, looking at the concentration of violent urban crime to a small number of residents and what that might mean for policing. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or ideas, reactions to the history of what's been called broken windows policing around the United States? If you live or have lived somewhere that people see as a violent or dangerous community, what do you want people to know about where you live? What do you think police can do to try to deal with crime? And what do you think communities, with or without the police, in efforts can do to try to prevent crime? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. In your piece in City Lab, Stephen, you also talk about really targeted efforts looking at the people who are prone to or who have joined gangs or similar organizations. What kind of targeted approaches are there to, I guess, get them back out and prevent them from getting involved in the violence that can come along with it?
Sure. It's a great question. And one of the distinctions that I think is really important to start with is that just because someone is in a group or is in a gang does not mean they're going to commit a homicide or commit a shooting. In reality, even within that very small population that we're discussing here, that 0.5%, 0.5 of 1%, only a very, very small number of people within that population, within that group population, is actually going to be committing or going to be victimized by violence. That said, what we do know is that by focusing on the people in those groups, by trying to promote pro-social norms within the groups themselves, we can help reduce violence before it starts. Now, that can look like a couple things. That can look like connecting the individuals within those groups with the type of counseling and support that they need. It can mean looking to support them in very small ways that may reduce the friction or their that they face or their vulnerability to being victimized. It can look like providing bus passes. It can look like cognitive behavioral therapy. But it can also look like providing connections between often those young people and the people who are already in those communities, people who may have been involved in gangs in the past, people who may be community leaders, who do authentically care for those young people, who do care for them to be alive and out of prison, and help to support and bolster those sorts of connections within the community and get the message to them clearly that the violence needs to stop and that they need to be part of the community as well. The whole shift here is about understanding that there really are a small number of people that we can be focusing our resources on instead of deploying law enforcement as a sole response to a whole community.
And in your piece, you write that with the broken windows style of policing, we may do very well at arresting people for a lot of lesser crimes. That doesn't necessarily translate into doing things like solving homicides.
Exactly. It's, in fact, a completely different type of law enforcement. And what we do find in many communities that are considered by some to be dangerous, but what we will refer to as communities that face high levels of violence, is what really matters to people is the fact that there is often no justice and no accountability for those very serious forms of crime, for those shootings, for those homicides. And if you're not investing enough energy and resources and capacity in trying to solve those fundamental problems, then it doesn't matter if you're going to arrest people for drinking on the stoop or for having marijuana, because that's not the type of issue that's going to get the community to trust that you're there to protect them from the things that matter most.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Eric is calling from Chicago. Eric, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was just kind of curious on the gentleman's thoughts with family law. We've been very aware of the statistics and the situations he speaks of, but sadly, we've been bringing this to so many different entities, you know, from the far left to the right and everyone in between. But family law, when we know that approximately 90% of those cases that you're speaking of are directly related to fatherless homes and situations where the very government and or the law enforcement communities are responsible for taking children away from parents and so on, why aren't we addressing it from that approach if we know that that accounts for, like I say, you know, 80 to 90%, depending on, you know, major crime, thefts, rapes, murders, and so on.
Eric, thanks a lot for the call. So Stephen concerns about, and people have raised this issue, concerns about lack of sufficient family, adult supervision for kids. Also concerns about if a lot of the males in a community are in prison, they're obviously absent from parenting in that situation, too.
Sure. So I think an important point to start with here is that this might be an issue of correlation, but not causation, right? That I wouldn't dispute the caller's facts, perhaps, about a correlation between fatherless homes and those who commit violence. But it's clear that that's not what the cause is, right? Because we know that there are, in fact, far more people who live in fatherless homes than people who commit violence. That this is not, in fact, a causal mechanism, that what we really need to look at, and this is what the evidence shows us year after year, decade after decade, is that violence in these communities is a product of the distrust and underprotection that there's been in those communities for decades. And that that distrust of law enforcement, the distrust of and often very justified distrust of the state institutions that are meant to support and protect people, that that's what the basis of this violence really is. And so there may be questions about family, home life that should be addressed perhaps through other means, through community organizations, through social supports, but it's not to us and to the data a question of violence.
Thanks for the call, Eric, at 800-642-1234. We're talking about violent crime and policing with Stephen Lurie, writer, former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities. He wrote a piece on the topic in CityLab. Stephen, can you point to a any communities around the country you think who are doing some of the things you're talking about and getting positive results from it?
Sure. So there are actually quite a few. I don't want to say success stories because whenever you have high levels of violence in a given city, whenever you have one homicide, it's too many. But you could look at a couple cities from the smaller ones up northeast, such as Newburgh, New York, to more of a mid-sized, larger city over in Oakland, California, that have been using a really focused approach to these small groups of people in order to prevent violence. And both cities have been deploying in conjunction law enforcement capacity, social service capacity, community capacity to really focus on these groups, people who are in these groups, communicate to them, support them where possible, protect them when they can, and use law enforcement when necessary. And both examples have had really significant reductions in their homicides and shootings over the last few years.
Stephen, the things you're talking about there are nuanced. They're hard to explain quickly in some ways. It's easy for maybe politicians in particular to do things that we could describe as tough on crime, cracking down on crime. Does that make it an uphill battle to propose these ideas?
You know, I think that it has in the past. And I think that it's been difficult because there is some sort of intuitive charm yet to the idea that when we're tough, we're going to get results. But I think at this point, the tide has really turned in terms of the understanding that a decade, two decades, three decades of a failed approach of broken windows hasn't made communities safer. And what we're excited about with our research and what we're excited about with others' research over the last 10 and 20 years is that we've seen that when you do focus on the small numbers of people, that can also be intuitive because communities already know this. Right? If we're listening to the communities where the violence is the highest, they are the ones that have known and know still that it's not an entire neighborhood that's dangerous. It's that there are people who need support. There are people who need to be focused on, who need, in some cases, attention from law enforcement. And that I think now we're seeing the tide turning and that can also be an intuitive idea if we're listening to the facts and listening to the people who live in those communities themselves.
Now, if we have a community where violent crime rates are high, disproportionately high compared to even other comparable communities around the country, I guess I'll throw out an example of a place like Baltimore right now, and there is that lack of trust between communities and the police department. How do you start? What is step one to get from where they are now to what you're talking about?
It's a difficult question, certainly. And I think this is where the field of sort of criminology and criminal justice really has to mix with that of conflict resolution and sociology and psychology and history. And I think that one of the first steps that's necessary whenever you're going to engage and try to turn the page on a past chapter is a recognition that there's been failure. And I think where we've seen the most success is when we've seen cities recognize publicly to their community that there's been a failure to protect and to serve and to support the communities that face the highest levels of violence. And in doing so, they gain a little bit of trust in being on the same page, in reconciling their vantage point with the community's vantage point about where they've been. And in doing so, can start to work together on where they should go next.
Is there a requirement, I guess, that there's community engagement, that this isn't a top-down approach, that as you're coming up with these solutions, community stakeholders are at the table from day one?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's part of the history that we've seen, is that when you try and use repressive policing, repressive tactics, these are things that are coming from the top, that are coming often from external sources and aren't what the community asks for or isn't the way that the community is asking for law enforcement support. And the fact is that the vast majority of violence is going to be prevented because the community is able to prevent it with the support of those who are working on violence reduction efforts. And so if you want to be effective, the places where we've seen the most effective violence reduction is where the community is on board and as a major stakeholder in doing the work.
Stephen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Stephen Lurie, writer and former researcher for the National Network for Safe Communities. He was with us to talk about violent crime and policing. He says law enforcement needs to move beyond the broken windows school of policing. Coming up, we'll talk about the college admissions bribery scandal that's been dominating the news the last couple of days and wider concerns about bias and inequality when it comes to higher education. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Ohio won the big prize, but the home team did pretty well, too. Join Kate Archer-Kent and her guest for a look at the results of the National Cheese Competition and share your favorite cheese from Wisconsin or, I guess, beyond. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, more than 50 people were indicted this week as part of a widespread college admissions bribery case. At the heart of the story is a California businessman named William Singer who worked with college officials and wealthy parents to guarantee spots for children at top-tier universities.
Between roughly 2011 and 2018, wealthy parents paid Singer about $25 million in total to guarantee their children's admission to elite schools, including Yale, Georgetown, Stanford, the University of Southern California, the University of Texas, UCLA, and Wake Forest.
That's U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling. While this case is unique in scope, it shines a light on criticisms of the admissions process and accusations that the process is more favorable to some students than others. Aaron Richards is a national education reporter for USA Today. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, give us a little more sense of what exactly was going on. What were these parents paying for and what were they getting?
Right. So this was a scheme that involved very wealthy parents essentially paying for access for their kids who may not have been qualified to get into the front door of these elite schools, which, of course, requires high grades or really good athletic performance or both. And we're finding multiple ways to come in through what Mr. Singer called a side door that he developed, which operated by either paying for proctors to help students get higher scores on their SAT or ACT exams. It also included helping these students get onto the sports teams of the non-elite sports teams at these schools for non-scholarship positions, which has long been, those are valuable seats that are generally reserved for walk-on students, and coaches were in on the bribery scheme to then sell those to parents as a way to get their children in the side door. And I think, you know, what's really made people raise their eyebrows about this whole thing, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about how, you know, the rich are already a step ahead of sort of normal people out there trying to play by the rules. But the fact that there would be evidence of, photoshopping kids' heads onto different athletes to prove their athletic performance history, or creating fake identification for an imposter student to take the SAT or the ACT exam for you, flights across the country to make this scheme happen. It's been a tantalizing story for, of course, parents and students, but also people in the education world. And of course, to top it off with a bunch of celebrities, it just kind of makes it an irresistible story.
And I've seen at least some experts out there saying this probably isn't these aren't the only cases of this happening. There's a good chance there are other people not just using their wealth to leverage getting into colleges and universities, which we'll talk about in a minute in general, but there's probably more illegal behavior out there. Tip of the iceberg is a phrase people are throwing around. What are you seeing as far as that possibility?
Of course, but you know, this, I think that is strongly people's suspicion. Certainly the prosecutors have alluded to that as well. But all of this requires somebody to have a tip about what's happening as well. You know, sometimes these stories break because a reporter gets a word of something happening, and one thing leads to another. In this case, I mean, we all in the media got this at about the same time because the Department of Justice released the news, and we were all kind of found out that this had been something that had been under investigation for a year. So I'm curious to see if they've got more that they'll release on this, but I don't think anyone has any doubts that there's lots of different ways that parents are, you know, paying for access, and this just may be the beginning.
Talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, looking at this big college admissions bribery and fraud scandal. Lots of people being charged with trying to get their kids access illegally into a lot of elite universities. I want to give another listen to U.S. Attorney now, Andrew Lelling, talking about these indictments.
We have charged 33 parents nationwide with hiring Singer's Group to defraud testing companies and or various universities. These parents are a catalog of wealth and privilege. They include, for example, CEOs of private and public companies, successful securities and real estate investors, two well-known actresses, a famous fashion designer, and the co-chairman of a global law firm.
Aaron, a question a lot of people have raised is, with people with this kind of privilege, access, wealth, why do they need to break the law? Aren't there plenty of legal things that they could have done that nobody would have blinked an eye at to get their kids into college? People in these situations tend to have ways to find access to these universities.
You know, the best explanation that I heard from this was from a pretty well-known and popular college consultant who said, look, you know, the pressure to get in to have your kid be at one of these elite universities has become so strong that even, you know, I mean, somewhat B-level, I mean, not that Felicity Huffman is a B-level celebrity, but certainly someone from a popular sitcom in the 90s, you know, even these people are going to extraordinary lengths to get their kids a foot in the door, that there's so much pressure even among the celebrity elite and among people that are close to the 1% that they're engaging in this kind of behavior because it's so important to have that status symbol of your kid at an elite college.
Now, the federal prosecutor said, hey, this isn't a case of, you know, you donate a building to get your kid into a school. The laws are being broken. And one reaction to this has been, well, wait a minute. Why is it okay to buy a building at a school to get your kid in if they're not otherwise qualified? Is this making people take a closer look at the legal ways that wealthy people get their kids into colleges?
Of course. And that was brought up by several critics who watched the press conference. You know, I think the quote was something along the lines of, you know, this isn't just parents buying a building. This is real fraud. And a bunch of people kind of sat back on their heels and said, wait a minute, we're just willing to say that it's perfectly acceptable for a parent to buy a chemistry building and that gets their child a second look. I mean, that was certainly one of the quotes that stood out in this, you know, 200 plus page affidavit, is that Singer himself was recorded telling a parent, you know, look, I mean, the front door is you're highly qualified and you get in fair and square. The, you know, the back door is that you pay off the advancement office. The side door is this other mechanism I found to get your kid in as an athlete in a non-elite sport. And so I think that's where people are really kind of taking stock of, I mean, not that everybody didn't know that the game was rigged, but it's just, it's a very glaring example, and it's certainly a talker.
Now, one reaction I've seen from some people in higher education was, hope this doesn't come to us, hope we don't end up in these headlines, but are you seeing reactions along the lines of, hey, maybe we need to re-examine our admissions policies to prevent the illegal stuff, but also to look at the legal ways wealthy people get access?
A little bit, but I mean, first off, you're seeing universities try to distance themselves from the employees who they're just calling bad actors. You know, Yale sent out an email to all of their alumni saying, you know, we can't believe this happened to us. You know, these coaches, you know, failed us. And in reality, I think that the situation behind closed doors in many admission offices across the country is much more serious about what needs to be done. I mean, I think there's been legitimate criticism of whether admissions offices did their due diligence in checking out kids who were recommended by coaches. Certainly a Google search or two on some of these students would have revealed the lack of any athletic history. And so I think that's where a lot of the conversation is going to start. I think you've also seen some level of criticism and scrutiny on the college consultant industry, which is a fast-growing industry of independent consultants, some of which are really good at helping students find a right-fit university, and some of which are people that are just making a quick buck on families that are nervous and are willing to do anything and to pay anyone if they can get some kind of guarantee that their kid's going to solidify their spot at a top-notch school.
We're talking to Erin Richards right now. She's a national education reporter for USA Today. She's with us to talk about this recent scandal involving wealthy parents bribing top-tier college officials to admit their children through an intermediary named William Singer, who earned tens of millions of dollars from these parents, 50-plus indictments, I think, at this point. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this news? What do you think it says about the college admissions process? How do you think the process should change, if at all, if you work in higher education? What are you thinking right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about a college admissions bribery and fraud scandal that made big news this week. Erin Richards is with us, national education reporter for USA Today. You can join in with your reactions to this story at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the college admissions process? Do you think changes need to be made? What are your thoughts on the news that wealthy parents, in effect, bought their kids spots at top schools around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mark joins us now in Two Rivers. Mark, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm not surprised that this has happened at all. And I suspect that it hits a lot closer to home than we realize. I'm a graduate of the University of Illinois down in Champaign, part of the Big Ten, the same as Wisconsin. And my parents were sharing with me a few years ago where the Board of Governors got themselves in a lot of trouble because they were showing preferential treatment for admission into the universities. And in an amazing feat of honesty, the governor stepped in to stop it, and end up several of those individuals end up losing their job.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. How common is this kind of preferential treatment, Aaron, for wealthier students, for donors, for, as far as we know anyway, for so-called legacy students? How much, preferential treatment is there for them?
Well, look, I mean, you can see that anywhere. It's really common for the children of wealthy donors or wealthy alumni to get preferential placement in the school. Usually, you know, schools are pretty concerned about things like rankings in U.S. News and World Report, where you have, you know, the class rank or GPA or test scores of incoming freshmen noted. But there's certainly ways to work around that. And I mean, everybody has kind of known for a long time that there are these sort of legacy ways to get in. And again, I just say that I think the more brazen style of cheating that shot some of these other children up to the top of the list is what people are sort of reeling at now. But I think it's a good time for a national discussion about what's fair. These colleges have, I mean, not operated as a meritocracy for that many years. Many of these legacy institutions, the Ivy Leagues, were always preferential to white males of privilege. So the fact that, you know, meritocracy, admitting students on ability alone, is a relatively new thing. And I think in some ways this has just shown that there hasn't actually been that much progress made on that front.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Gary is with us in South Milwaukee. Gary, hello.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Gary?
I just was telling the person before you, as usual, the rich and powerful get away with murder. I don't know how people that are just Joe Lunchbox, blue collar, have a way of even competing against this kind of greed. That's all it is. It's greed.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. And that's another question that's come up, Aaron. An education at a school like this for somebody coming from a lower income level can be a real difference maker, a real road to social mobility, potentially. Gary, seeing the rich and powerful winning out again, though.
Sure. I mean, it's a common complaint. I think people have a right to be upset about it. I think in many ways it just, again, throws into stark relief the divide between a lot of people with a lot of wealth and power and privilege and those who don't have as much. And one person I interviewed for this story pointed out something that he thought was really critical, which is that on these campuses, elite universities, children of color, teenagers of color, are still a very sizable a very small minority of the student population, and that in many ways, those students are walking around thinking, man, I don't think I belong here, or they're kind of made to feel like they don't belong in those universities, even though they got in based on their ability. And here you have students who clearly didn't have the ability at all and just had the money, and those are the kids that really don't belong there. And so there's certainly been a lot of discussion, especially on Twitter, about what this means for children of color and children of low economic means who do figure out a way to get to the top, and how they may have been losing out on placements to these students who weren't actually academically qualified at all.
Right. One reaction I've seen is there's often a presumption for those students from minority backgrounds that they're there because of affirmative action, that they somehow don't deserve it. And people argue, well, wait a minute, we have this really big system of affirmative action for people with money.
Of course. And I think that is something that especially for young people who grow up with that mentality, to have to fight against that perception all the time can be really wearing. And we don't ever think twice about whether one of the white students walking around actually deserves to be there.
Talking to Aaron Richards from the USA Today, higher education reporter there, looking at this big bribery and fraud scandal in college admissions. Back to your calls. Donna is with us in Milwaukee. Donna, hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, and you've kind of already touched on it, how many students that deserved to get in there did not get in there?
Donna, thanks. I assume, Aaron, we don't have a number on that, but that is one thing people are wondering.
Right. I mean, I think that it's a great question. It's really hard to quantify at this point. I mean, you could certainly say, I mean, this is a small point, but you could certainly say that some more qualified, you know, rower or sailor or tennis player might have had a shot at playing an NCAA sport, didn't get a chance to because kind of a student who was athletically unqualified took that spot instead. But it's hard to quantify at this point, and I haven't seen any numbers on that, you know, exactly how many kids were not able to get in who actually were qualified because of these other placements that were happening.
Donna, thanks for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Aaron, another angle on this story. One of the ways of cheating and gaming the system here was students being coached and parents being coached to make false claims of disability in order to get accommodations that then they could take advantage of to cheat. People in the disability advocacy community very upset about this.
You know, we're trying to nail this one down, and if any of your callers have tips or leads on it, Aaron.Richards@USAToday.com. We've heard a lot of SAT tutors and ACT tutors saying that they see enormous numbers of kids, I mean, overwhelming numbers of kids at wealthier schools, both public and private, who have ADHD accommodations, which requires generally at least two things, a script or a prescription from a psychologist or psychiatrist that diagnoses that and outlines some level of your accommodations. And then you typically also need to have, either an individual education plan from the school or a 504 plan is another term for kind of a special needs plan for you that would then give you additional time on the test. And what some of the tutors that we've interviewed have said is that this can really be a game changer for a student who could get the accommodation to, say, maybe have time and a half on the ACT exam. That would give you, 6 hours on the test instead of four. And then in some cases, these kids are taking the test over multiple days. So imagine only having to concentrate for an hour to take this exam, per day over a number of days rather than all at once. Now, of course, those accommodations are necessary for students who actually have learning disabilities, other disabilities that require them to have special accommodations. What people are increasingly concerned about is that that privilege is being abused in some way, either through false prescriptions or other manufactured documents that are somehow giving these students the accommodations on the test. I mean, that was one of the questions about how did one of these students who was involved in the scandal get to be able to sit with a private proctor who had been bribed to either change the answers after the fact or to feed the answers to the student during the test. Well, if that student didn't actually have a learning disability and was getting this accommodation, how did that happen? Who is writing the scripts? Who is allowing these things to be given to students who don't legitimately have the special needs?
Aaron, we're just about out of time. We have these indictments now. We're going to have trials, I assume, or pleas. But what are you watching for next, and what are you following as this story develops?
I just published a story about an hour ago that's looking at the world of college consulting and how that industry has really grown. There's a lot of good people working in there, but there's certainly a whole world of folks that are paying a lot of money to try to get their kids a leg up in that world. We are also looking at, again, the special needs stuff, and we'll be following the story as it develops and, as people plead or as other, punishments are doled out.
And briefly, one of our callers is wondering, what happens to the kids who got in under these false pretenses? That's an open question, right?
It is a total open question. I think the universities involved are still reeling. They have not figured out exactly what to do yet. And, already today there was a lawsuit filed from some other students who are now saying that their degree won't be worth as much if it comes from one of these institutions where there were questionable student placements.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks a lot.
That's Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today. She joined us to talk about the college admissions bribery and fraud scandal that led to the indictment of more than 50 people this week, including business leaders, actors, and others.